Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with James Lee Burke, whose new novel is Every Cloak Rolled in Blood. Times best-selling author James Lee Burke is one of the most honored writers in the field of crime fiction, a grandmaster and a two-time Edgar Award winner, and one of the most beloved of all American writers. He's prolific, too, the author of two story collections and 40 novels. This year, he's back with one of his best, Every Cloak Rolled in Blood. He's speaking to us today from his home in Missoula, Montana. Jim Burke, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you for having me on your program. It's an honor to be here.
It's so good to hear your voice. Every Cloak Rolled in Blood is one of those books where a reader can tell that the author's just gone flat out and put every bit of heart and soul into it. So talk a little bit about the origin of this book, which I know was really a sad time in your life, and I am so sorry about that, the loss of your daughter. So writing this book must have helped you or served a purpose in your life.
Well, it was a very difficult period, and we lost our daughter, and I can't say exactly how the book came about. I had started writing a short story that had to do with the pandemic and, not only the pandemic, but the fallout and how it has been politicized and some of the darker sides of America beginning to just come out of a swamp that we hoped had disappeared, but It's nativism, actually. Anyway, I was writing a short story, and then we lost our daughter, and that story became the larger story of an author who loses his daughter. And I wanted to give my daughter, Pamela, some recognition because she was one of the best people I ever knew, without exception. She was a remarkable person, and I wanted to portray her as the person she was because she was an extraordinary person. And I think she helped me with this book. She was, she worked for me. She was my film agent.
Right.
My confessor, psychologist.
She was woven into your professional life in every way.
That's right. Yeah.
So tell us about Aaron Holland Broussard, the protagonist. He's a successful writer in his 85th year, and he's taking stock of life.
Well, yes, he is, and I'm going against the grain using protagonists that are octogenarians. I don't know.
Oh, well.
There's no country in the world, and I say this with the best feelings, there's no country in the world that is more naive about age than the United States. It's because we are a revolutionary country. We're still a very young one ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Most people have notions about age that have nothing to do with reality.
That's true.
And one of the big ones is that wisdom does not come with age, at least in my case. It surely has passed me by. That's the big punch in the face. When you're in the ninth inning, if that's it, or whatever. That's another one. Look, what is the measure of time? There, people who live more in 3 days than people who live 3 years. Hemingway talked about that in For Whom the Bell Tolls. But anyway, he's a very good character. His name is, of course, associated with the Holland family from Texas, and that's my own family. My mother was a Holland, and there were quite a group of people, and I've written,
a lot.
14, a lot of books about them. Those books have not been read as much, but actually my three best novels up to this one are about the Hollands, and the character whom we meet in what I call the Pamela book, book is from those earlier books. And I think my three best books are House of the Rising Sun, The Jealous Kind, and Wayfaring Stranger.
I love those books, yeah.
Yeah, and I have to say, I think unbeatable in terms of, I love the other books I've written, but the best one may be Wayfaring Stranger. It's the story of the Depression and World War II. And it's I have to say, one of those special ones.
Mm-hmm. And you can tell, you can feel it. But one of the fascinating things about these books, Jim, is that they could happen anywhere in America. I mean, there are so many beautiful places. They're tainted by political corruption, industrial pollution, human greed, the lust for power. But you've staked your claim in, you know, three places, Louisiana, Montana, and Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And Montana's the heartbreaking, beautiful place that Aaron goes to think about his loss and mourn his daughter.
That's correct. And you put your hand on it. The three states where I've centered my stories the most might seem geographically removed from one another, but that's not the case at all. They share much in common, particularly their history, much of which is a dark one. And I made use of that in the story, Every Robe Clothed in Blood, with a portrayal of what were the genocidal and deliberate policies after the war between the states toward Indians. And it was genocide. And, of course, the example that I use in this book is the murder of the Blackfeet Indians on the Marias River in the year, I think, 1870. But it was horrible, and it was deliberate. But it was only one of many. For example, people get excited about what William Sherman did in the South, and my own feelings are that he was a terrorist. He was not a hero. He declared war on civilians, but he didn't stop with his advocacy. Most of those guys, those Union generals back then, when they got finished with the South, they went to work on the Indians.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody points that out with tearing down statues. They're really, a lot of guys, they'd ought to get on their list.
It's like, think this through. I mean,
great.
Oh, my goodness.
There's very select rage going on here. But people like Custer were genocidal errand. They send a message, in other words, that either the Indians undid themselves or they would be simply excoriated and finally wiped off the map. And they did a pretty good job, and they did it in the most dishonorable way. They did it with starvation.
Mm-hmm.
Deliberate. And Sherman was an advocate of killing all the buffalo. They reduced the herd, which was about 50 million head during the 1830s. By the early 1890s, the entire herd herd was about 200 animals. That was it. That's what we did, and it was done deliberately to bring the Indians to their needs.
Well, tell me how it feels when you bring one of these historical figures out of the mist, and you're living with them for a while, and you're kind of in their heads for a bit. What is that like for you?
Well, that's a good question. Everyone who's been in psychoanalysis knows this. The first day he sees the analyst asks the question, do you hear voices in your head? If you're smart, you'll say, no, never, because you will be in a straitjacket in electroshock therapy within 24 hours because it's symptomatic of schizophrenia. But I've heard voices all my life. My head is always full of voices. And I really feel that one of the great challenges to any artist, no matter the medium, whether he or she is an actor, sculptor, painter, that is to give voice to those who have none, either oppressed people or the dead. You know, ancient people put flagstones, we call them gravestones, mm-hmm. They pile them on the ground on top of the buried person to trap his spirit, to keep his spirit in the ground. Well, they have ways of getting out. That's my own feeling is, my father believed that all time happens simultaneously. He used to say that the past, the present, the future happen as though a dream in the mind of God.
Mm-hmm.
The artist and the scientist is actually not a creator. He's a discoverer of what already exists. And I think that's really, if there's any wisdom that I've acquired, I didn't generate it. I think that's it. I think that's where we are. Heaven's not in the next world. It's already here. Like someone once said about the Indian attitude toward eternity, they look at the earth as a place that has no fences. They used to call it the ghost trail. They just disappear into it, but they don't go away. They're still there. And I believe that. Pamela was psychic. Pamela had experiences with the dead appeared to her with the messages for me. I've tried to be the devil's advocate and dismiss the things she told me, but there's no way to explain them.
And they had real-world consequences for you as well.
Their names, they gave their names to her and twice into, they were apparitions that appeared to her. And she was like that when she was 2 or 3 years old. The main character in Wayfair Stranger was my cousin. It's based on Weldon Mallett. He was part of the Holland Benbow family.
Mm-hmm.
But he was the war hero, and I and the family. And I loved Weldon, and his nickname was Buddy. But he appeared to her with my uncle and another cousin. And Aunt Pamela did not know these people. She never would have heard their names. She couldn't know the things they said to tell me because they warned me that Pearl and I were going to have a terrible accident on the highway with a vehicle that was carrying what looked like pipe on the trailer. But it was not pipe, it was something else. It was a weird kind of premonition to begin with. It happened.
It did happen, Jim. Oh, my gosh.
It happened. And had I not swerved, the fellow, he was taking, it was a truck driver who was ahead of me going uphill, up a mountain here in North Montana. And he had boomed down all these lodgepole logs, you know, huge things, mm-hmm. and the tips of them were bouncing off the end of the trailer, so it looked like pipe. And I thought, gee, I'm looking like that. And then he slipped a log. I swerved. It missed the front of my car about 18 inches. And this was in highway traffic. It would have killed us probably or hurt us very badly, but I swerved and I missed it.
Oh.
That was Pomelo, but there's no way to make this up.
Yeah.
These were my mother's side of the family. Mm-hmm. They were the closest members of the Holland-Benbow family.
And they were being stewards of the family line, you know?
There's no other explanation. When I answered the phone, she was crying when she called, and I had to sit down. When she used their names, my knees literally gave out.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, this isn't happening. She had no way to know the name because they were the nicknames from decades ago. My uncle, who was in the Pacific Theater, and my cousin, who shot himself to death. But they were all there, and they used my nickname as a child.
Wow. Now, this is one of your novels where things like that happen. It takes place in a shifting world of time where historical figures roam the landscape. And one of those characters is Aaron's daughter, who speaks to him as if she's standing right next to him, because she is. And that otherworldly sense of connection, that's been part of your work all along. I go back and I think to some of those scenes in The Electric Mist with Confederate Dead. I mean, some of those were just exquisite writing.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I always believe that if there's any wisdom we learn it from the past. And it's one of our shortcomings that history is given short shift in the United States, in our schools, and in people's general attitudes. I mean, we say something has antique ideas or antiquated, like the ancient world is bad.
And it's
for people. Freud got all of his nomenclature from the Golden Age of Pericles. Greek mythology was there before. I mean, 2,400 years earlier.
You just saw it.
Freud, and he would be the first to say that. They had the best understanding of human psychology in the history of the world. Nobody can match them. And the same is with storytelling. It is always emblematic. Carl Jung said that history is in the human. It's not just out there in books. It's in the unconscious. 90% of the human brain is a huge library of experience. It's a matter of creating a conduit into it. That's why Shakespeare said, all power lies in the world of dreams.
Mm-hmm. That's why I think so many people refer to writing as an act of grace, because you just have to open yourself up and let it pass through you, you know?
That's it. This is the only area with which we share on an equal basis with God.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. The Creator himself. This is the gift, and not to use it is a form of undoing of the Spirit. That's what the Spirit is, I think. I mean,
that's one of the things about Aaron, because he's contemplating what he's done with his life and his gifts. And you show his desire to write, his desire for young women, his, you know, and that tension of desire to end it all. So he's kind of bound up with all those things that happened at that time of life.
Well, that's it. He's dealing with mortality, and it can be a daunting experience. Those who are cavalier about it are shining people on, but I don't dwell on it. This is the way I feel about it. Everything is relative. And there are people who are 30 years old who I would not trade places with. I cannot imagine devoting myself, and I don't want to denigrate anyone else, but I cannot understand people who walk around with a cell phone glued to the side of their head. They don't talk to other people, particularly young people.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it seems a miserable way to live, for God's sakes.
I take it I'm not talking to you on a cell phone, Jim.
No, I'm not on a cell phone.
No, I'm with you on that one. I avoid it whenever possible. One of the most interesting parts of the copy of the book that I got, which was an advanced reader's copy, was a letter that you wrote to readers. You think about your readers a lot and you address them directly and they feel connected to you. And this is a very meaningful and moving section. And I wondered if you'd just read a little bit of it for us now.
Well, thank you for inviting me to read it. All righty. This novel is fiction and the characters are fictitious. But the world and the larger human story are not fiction. The narrator, Aaron Holland Broussard, describes his loss as a hole in his chest that is as big as a pie plate, a hole that is like a blue sky with carrion birds inside it. He has vertigo and can't breathe or concentrate on a conversation or drive a car. His gun cabinet beckons to him like a dirty whisper in his ear. The book enters what others might call the supernatural. It is fine that others do that, but I believe the natural world is a metaphysical entity, and I also believe that most conventional wisdom and science are of only moderate worth, and I believe that we do not all come from the same tree, and that gargoyles are real and waiting for their time to come round. I also believe the Garden of Eden is within our grasp if we will only appreciate the enormity of the great gift that has been given us by a divine hand. That's what this book is about. Some scars never leave us, but scars can't break us. Only we can do that. As Ernest Hemingway said, the world is a fine place and worth the fighting for. I hope you like this book. It's by far my best, even though I feel that another hand wrote it for me.
Jim, you take my breath away. Well, you've been talking with James Lee Burke about his most recent book, Every Cloak Rolled in Blood. Don't miss it. Jim, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Jefferson Parish Library will host its third Food Writers Symposium beginning at noon Saturday, June 25th at the River Ridge Library, 8825 Jefferson Highway in River Ridge. The purpose of the symposium is to encourage people to create cookbooks so recipes won't be lost and instead will be collected and passed on to the next generation. Here's the schedule. From noon to 1:15, Elizabeth Williams, founder of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum and president of the National Food and Beverage Foundation, talks about the art of the cookbook. From 1:30 to 2:45 p.m., Poppy Tooker, host of WWNO's Louisiana Eats radio show, talks about the importance of recipe testing. From 3 to 4:15, what are publishers and editors looking for? That's with Cynthia Lejeune Nobles, author of the Confederacy of Dunces cookbook, recipes from Ignatius J. Riley's New Orleans, and Chef Jared Zarang, author of Southern and Smoked, Cajun Cooking Through the Seasons. Award-winning author Mary Walsh will be signing copies of her novel Fine Spirits Served Here. That's at Hermes Bar in Antoine's Restaurant at 725 St. Louis Street in the French Quarter. Saturday, June 25th from 2 to 4. Tickets are available at Eventbrite. Darby Bayham signs Bloom Where You're Planted, Saturday, June 25th at 5 at Blue Cypress Books. Shannon Atwater presents a story time and signs Alligators Don't Like Flowers, Sunday, June 26th from 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at Blue Cypress Books. Maurice Carlos Ruffin and friends celebrate the paperback release of his book, The Ones Who Don't Say They Love You, Stories, Wednesday, June 29th at 5 at The Orange Couch, 2339 Royal Street, sponsored by Blue Cypress Books. The New Orleans Poetry Journal is seeking submissions for an upcoming anthology that features the work of poets who participated in the Poetry Buffet reading series. Please submit your three best poems of any length to submissions at neworleanspoetryjournal.com. Include a brief cover letter and bio with the poems in a single PDF or Word document. The submission period runs from June 15th until July 31st. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.